Okay, I think it's time to begin. We are continuing our study in the book of Luke for this quarter. We finished the last quarter where different men took the class each week. And this quarter, I'm taking it for a month. I believe Era is taking it for the next month. Talk louder, is that what that means? Okay. Sorry. Then Era's taking it for the next month. And then I believe Brother Witt, is that right? That's right. Okay, so he's taken the last month. That will get us through the book of Luke completely. So if you'll turn to Luke 14, that's where we're gonna. That's the chapter we're gonna study tonight. And you can be turning there. And I want to just mention, because some of these are gonna come up in this chapter as we study it this evening. To kind of get our minds back in the Luke mindset, and really just the Gospels in general. I want to go back and read chapter 1. You don't have to turn there, but I'm just going to read how Luke starts this off by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. He says, "Inasmuch as many have taken in hand, set in order the narrative of those things which have been fulfilled among us, just as those who were from the beginning wrote, eyewitnesses and ministers of the word delivered them to us. It seemed good to me also, having had a perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write to you an orderly account, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the certainty of those things in which you were instructed." Okay, so obviously it's to Theophilus, but the application is to us still, that these are these things that were written down through this account of the gospel that Luke provides for us, also through other ones. And we talked about how Luke is focusing on this idea of salvation, focusing on this idea of the Gentiles are part of this process now, this new way. But really, more broadly speaking, Luke, and maybe all the Gospels, this is the case, is they're talking about the inception of this new way, of this new dispensation that Christ is bringing. And it's referred to many times as the kingdom that's coming. And it's not an earthly kingdom, we know that. It's going to rule in your heart. There are passages to that effect. But all of this that we've looked at so far in the book of Luke, and as we continue to look at this, it's really pointing these people to this new way and trying to make them understand this new way, kind of understand what the Christian character is. What does it mean to be a Christian? How do you act when you're a Christian? And that comes in direct contrast many times, especially with the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the synagogue rulers and the priests and things like that, is where most of the conflict occurs with this. But the whole thing is Jesus trying to relay, or others trying to relay, this new way, this new dispensation that's coming into effect. So that's kind of what the argument that's going on, or the process that's going on here in Luke when we enter into chapter 14. That's kind of been going on the whole time. And Jesus finds himself in the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees, it says in 14 verse 1. And it says at the end of that verse, it says these Pharisees that were there, a lawyer, maybe more than one person, it appears, it says that they watched him closely. And that's probably not strong enough to what they were actually doing, because obviously not this particular verse, but this same phrase, they watched him closely. And the Septuagint has the idea of they were laying in wait. So it's almost like a lion, you know, kind of like laying in wait. We're gonna get you. You know, just get a little closer to the problem that we have with you, and we're gonna pounce on you. Okay, that's kind of what these guys were doing with Jesus in here. And behold, there was a certain man before him who had dropsy. And Jesus answering, I think that's really interesting. There wasn't a question. He's answering, he spoke to the lawyers and the Pharisees, saying, "Is it lawful to heal a man on the Sabbath?" There was no question that was ever asked. And maybe there was, but we don't have any indication of it here. I think probably what's going on, and I'll mention a couple of other instances in just a second, I think probably what's going on is Jesus is responding to what they have in their hearts and what he senses that is going on with them. and he's basically just destroying their argument before they can even make it. I kind of view it as they're sitting there saying, okay, we're laying in wait. We're going to watch this guy, and let's see what he does with this guy. If he does this, we can do this. And so he just says, okay, let me ask you a question. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? They kept silent because they didn't really have an answer for that because they were in this catch-22. And so he healed the guy because there wasn't any objection to that when he asked the question, apparently. And then he further convicted him in verse 5. Then he answered them saying, we don't have a record of any question here again. So to me, the way I read this is it's almost like they were like, okay, we got him. Now, what is he going to say if we say this? And he answered them saying, which of you having a donkey or an ox that had fallen in a pit will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day? And they couldn't answer him regarding these things. So really, really interesting, I think, because he just kind of left them speechless. It's almost, I envision this being Jesus just having the argument for them and the answer from him, and they don't even have to talk. They're just sitting there listening to him, and they're like, how did he know we were going to ask that question? How did he know that was what we were going to do? How did he, you know? And so, to me, that's some of the miraculous nature of this. So this idea of the Sabbath and healing on the Sabbath, have we seen that before? That's a pretty common thing. Actually, if you go back, even here in Luke, the very previous chapter in Luke 13, but I want to go back to Luke 6 first. We see it there in Luke 6. This is when we hear that Jesus is the Lord of the Sabbath, and we kind of get into this understanding in 6 through 11 of chapter 6. The first five verses have to do with the law of the Sabbath and what all that really meant. And then 6 through 11 has to do with healing on the Sabbath. And this is the scribes and the Pharisees watched him closely, verse 7, whether he would heal on the Sabbath. Of course, he did here in this point. And then verse 11, it says, they were filled with rage and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. So this little thing that they had set up about the Sabbath was really close to them. And this happens, and now they're going to figure out, okay, what are we going to do? Well, what they do, I think, probably we see in chapter 13, when he heals this woman with a spirit of infirmity for 18 years, verse 11 is where that is, and he heals this lady. But the ruler of the synagogue, verse 14, answered with indignation because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, and he said to the crowd, there are 6 days on which men ought to work, therefore come and be healed on them and not on the Sabbath. And then he says in verse 15 something very similar to what we just read in verse 5 of chapter 14. He says, does not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or donkey from the stall and lead him away to water? So do you not take care of the animals, which they were allowed to do that. But they didn't want to take care of people. They wanted to take care of the animals, but they didn't want to take care of people. And then we see here in chapter 14 that Jesus is just handling the whole situation without even their argument. He knows their argument already. He knows what they're going to say. So I kind of see a progression of him teaching the Pharisees or exposing the Pharisees' hypocrisy from the very beginning, kind of like, here's the real situation. Here's how it is. And, you know, I'm going to mention the animals and what you do with the animals. And then you're not even going to have to ask me. I'm just going to mention it to you. So he's kind of like, to me, it's like he's hitting harder and harder each time that this comes up. But this is a common issue, apparently. One of the things that the Pharisees obviously held close to them, and I just think it's very impressive that he left these guys speechless in this at least third time that particular issue is mentioned here in the book of Luke. All right, we're going to move on in just a second to this next part, 7 through 14, and what the parables there that are mentioned are the instances there that are mentioned. But does anybody have anything they'd like to add to the first 6 verses so far? Yes, ma'am.
I think it shows the biggest problem with the Pharisees and Sadducees and some of the other people that Christ, that, you know, were always watching Christ. they weren't watching to find out any information about him or how to better follow him, or really even what he was about. All they were afraid about was that they were being threatened, and they were just looking to see if they could find a way, in any way that he could mess up. He knew that they weren't interested in anything he really had to say. And it was their attitude that was...
Yeah. And actually, that's what a lot of the rest of this chapter is going to really focus on. It's kind of like this... And maybe some of what I mentioned earlier is the whole idea is to cause people to think differently, right? So these people were thinking about status and about knowledge and about tradition, honestly, was a lot of it and everything. And he's kind of turning that world upside down, like is mentioned in Acts, right? He's kind of changing the whole model of thinking there, and that's hard, especially for those people who would be considered the top of that. And it's mentioned again in the feast here in just a minute. This idea of humility. I mean, that's kind of the theme, I think, really of this chapter is humility. And the Pharisees and the scribes are really the antithesis of that, right? I mean, they're just as far away from humble as you could possibly imagine, because they've reached this position where they're perfect in their minds, right? Good point. Yes, sir.
There was no way for the Pharisees to be able to answer this question and remain a Pharisee, because man was not made for the Sabbath. Sabbath was made for man. And under that, with Christ claiming to be the Son of God, and them answering this question, they're admitting that, yes, you are the Son of God. And that's going to just raise too many hackles right there. And what Jesus is going on with this healing on the Sabbath, he later gets into what are you Pharisees who tithe over mint, cumin, and all that? When I seek mercy and justice. And so he's going to later progress to that.
Yeah, and that's right. And that's kind of what I meant by the catch-22 is, however they answered, and I think that's probably why they were silent. However they answered, they really couldn't. They really couldn't answer. There was a hand up right over here. Yes, sir.
Luke 6, verse 8, he said he knew their thoughts. So when you get into 14, he was giving them answers to things they were thinking about.
That's how I think that's some of the impressive part of this early part of
14. I read it as he's not even waiting for them to start making the argument. He's gonna nail them before they can even bring up their argument. Yes, sir.
7:23 says if a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, so that the law of Moses should not be broken, are you angry with me because I made a man completely well on the Sabbath? So there's another argument uses that. Yeah, he was a man, and you're worried about apples and stuff.
So all these things these Pharisees had built up and everything, he's kind of systematically just dismantling all of their traditions that they have, and he's doing it. And again, if you look even to that, if you look at the progression of things, he's increasing the power of his argument, I think, as time goes on here. All right, let's move on for time's sake and talk about this next section in 7 through 14. There's a couple of stories. The first one is said to be a parable. The second one, I believe, is a parable as well. To some extent, I guess, or I guess I would view it that way. Doesn't really matter. But the first one is the wedding feast that's being had, and it's talking about those people who go to the wedding feast. Be one of those people, not who goes up to the premier position, and so back in the day it would be, they would kind of line you up with your status, at least in this environment. They would line you up kind of in your status, and the person with the highest status would be closest to the bridegroom, closest to the wedding party, however that worked. And this is saying, don't just assume that you're the top, right? Don't go to that top seat. Instead, go to the bottom one and ask them to and then you might be asked to move up in line there. But if you go to the top one, you might be asked to move down in front of everybody. That's a little embarrassing. And then the second one has to do with the supper that's being thrown. And it's saying, go invite all these people that you wouldn't normally invite. And the reason why is because you don't need to do this with a self-involved, self-centered kind of aspect of, hey, I'm going to invite somebody that can reciprocate and invite me back and everything. You know, do it truly to help somebody out, or, you know, for those who can't repay you. And I think the key to this whole section, and we're gonna read a little bit of this, but I think the key to this whole section is found in verse 11. Maybe the key to the whole chapter, and maybe in some ways the key to the whole gospel here. It says, "For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." So humility is a key aspect of that Christian character that we're talking about, that's being developed through these gospels as Jesus is trying to relay to them this new order that's coming into place, this new dispensation that's happening. And so he's saying, be humble. And so with these stories, he's saying, eliminate the things like pride. Eliminate that self-serving spirit that people have. Eliminate that hypocritical spirit that so many have. And this is in the midst of talking about a lot about scribes and Pharisees, so it's probably centering on that behavior, at least. This is nothing new. If you turn back to Proverbs 25, it's something I have to think that this was in Jesus' mind when he said this. But if you look in Proverbs 25 and verse 6, it says, "Do not exalt yourself in the presence of the king, and do not stand in the place of the great, for it is better that he say to you, 'Come up here,' than that you should be put lower in the presence of the prince." And so, kind of saying the same thing. You know, it's better to humble yourself, start low, and be asked to rise up to a greater position than to start in a greater position and somebody pull you out and say, "No, you got to go down to this lower position." And then again, the second one is the same thing. Eliminate this self-serving attitude. The Christian character does not kind of have that self-serving attitude, I think, that's being not condemned maybe, but just exposed here. And I say that because there's nothing wrong with inviting your brothers or your friends or whoever to a dinner. But it's the attitude behind that. Are you doing that for reciprocation, or are you doing that because you care about somebody? Well, there's no question if you invite somebody that can't repay you. And it says at the end of verse 14, "For you shall be repaid at the resurrection of the just." And so, to me, I don't have too much more to say about that. Anybody can add anything they would like to, but I think the key here is he's really trying to get across to them to humble yourselves and don't think more highly of yourself than you should here. Anybody have any comments on that section before we move on? Yes, ma'am.
He's also trying to get them to recognize that we've all been invited to a feast by God, and none of us can repay that invitation that we have to sit at God's table. It's kind of like adopting a child. You don't adopt a child to come sit at your table because of what he can do for you. But he's poor and he'll never be able to repay you. But you do it for him. And that's what God has done. And Christ has done for us. They've invited us to a feast. So we need to reciprocate and do that for others.
Yeah, thanks a lot for making that point. And that's something I kind of passed over for time's sake, but it's really important. No, it's really important. So I'm glad you brought it up, because this idea of humbling ourselves, we really don't have any reason. Even the Pharisees, the Pharisees here, or the rich people, or whoever it might be here, relative to the other person, they might feel like they're better than that. But right, when we translate this to us, there's no way we can be better than the master. And we're going to see this in the parable of the Great Supper that's coming up next as well. But there's no way we can be anything other than in a humble position, before if we put ourselves in this situation. So it was easy for them, but you're right. We need to let that follow through to our lives now as well, because that's what's been done for us. JD?
Kind of an overall observation about this scene that seems Jesus has been invited to eat at this ruler's house. And he is not a, a docile guest. Just the things he's saying, the things he's doing, he's critiquing the other guests there for what they're doing. He's saying what needs to be said, even though it, I'm sure it was not the socially correct thing to do in that situation. I'm just impressed by his boldness, in spite of, you know, he's a guest at this person's house. Well, he's giving them what they need.
Right. Probably not was a rude. Very comfortable situation,
right?
You know, it's very hostile, but in a weird, like, under your breath sort of way. That they invite him in so they can trap him.
Right.
And he walks right in and you know, does what he needs to do.
Yeah, how many times has that happened,
right, in the life of Jesus? How many times do we see that, you know, them laying in wait, right? As it mentions here, the same kind of scenario. And Jesus comes in and just totally dismantles everything that they're trying to accomplish in just a few concise words. If I could figure out some of those words like that, you know, that would be awesome. But did you have your? Does anybody have their hand up over here? All right, let's move on to the parable of the great supper or the feast here that's being had. In verse 15, those who sat at the table with him heard these things and said to him, "Blessed is he who shall eat bread in the kingdom of God." And so here we see the kingdom of God, and we, you know, I don't have any reason to believe that this is sarcasm, and so I think there might be some people who recognize what's going on here and understand that. And he said to them, "A certain man gave a great supper and invited many, and he sent his servant at supper time to say to those who were in who were invited, 'Come, for the things... for things are now ready.' But they all with one accord began to make excuses. The first said to him, 'I've bought a piece of ground and I must go and see it. I ask you to have me excused.' Another said, 'I've bought five yoke of oxen and I'm going to test them. I ask you to have me excused.' Still another said, 'I've married a wife and therefore I cannot come.' So the servant came and reported these things to his master. The master of the house, being angry, said to his servant, 'Go out quickly into the streets and lanes of the city and bring in here the poor, the maimed, the lame, and the blind.' Servant went and did that. There was still room. He said, 'Go to the highways and the hedges and compel him to come in.' And then in verse 24, he says, 'For I say to you that none of those men who were invited shall taste my supper.'" All right, so the first thing that I notice about this is this in verse 18, it says, "But they all with one accord began to make excuses." And that one accord has this implication of they determined this together. They figured out together that this is what they were going to do. So this wasn't a you know, three people just decide they don't want to go and they're making excuses. There is some kind of conspiracy, I guess, if you want to call it that, to avoid this. And then you see the three excuses. The first one has to do with kind of material things, this piece of ground. Second one has to do with more business things, an oxen that would be worked with. And the third one has to do with personal things. These, incidentally, are reasons that men could come back from war in the Old Testament. These were some of the allowances that were given for that in Old Testament times. But these were just excuses, and it's clear here in this situation that they're just excuses. And I think the reality of this is for us that there's really not any excuse that's acceptable for refusing the gospel, is what I believe is being talked about here. And you have to be committed to the gospel and not to other things. And so. I think this probably, I don't know how much, but I think this probably has a whole lot to do with the Jew and Gentile transition from accepting the Gentiles eventually. This idea of the first ones rejected it; they weren't willing to come. So go get the not so great people, as we might think about it. And I think this has a lot of the Jew Gentile message coming through, that all are going to be invited. Not it's not a class thing. It's not Jews only, maybe, but it's also the Gentiles here. I don't know how much of it is really focusing on that and how much is more focused on the idea of accepting the invitation that Christ is putting forth here. I think, actually, that God is putting forth. I see Christ as the servant that goes out and tries to bring people to the feast. I see God as the master who sends him out, is how I kind of view this. But I think those two things are the main things that are going on here. Does anybody have anything else they'd like to add to that? I mean, there's a lot that we could spend time on this, but this last one of this last section is what I want to focus on probably more time than any. But we have some time, so if anybody would like to add anything about the supper here, I would love to hear it. Yes, sir.
Up again. To me, it looks like a direct condemnation of the Jews. If you put this out of perspective, because why did Jesus come? He only came to the Jews, and when they rejected it, then he sent the apostles and the different ones out to the Gentiles. But originally, he only came to the Jewish nation. And everything that had been done by God for the Jews, they basically rejected. And that's, to me, I think these relate back to that point of, look, God gave you every opportunity to accept Jesus as your king, not an earthly king, but a king for your spiritual soul, and they rejected him. And I think that's why he says, you go out and pick out the lame, and pick out the maimed, the blind, and all that. You pick out the ones that weren't Jews and bring them in now.
Yeah, and I mean, we know that he came, you know, I guess the passage will say he came for the Jew first and also for the Greek. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the Jews should have been prepared for him. They should have been ready for him. They should have been waiting for him. And they should be the ones who were the optimal audience for what he had to offer. And they weren't that. They weren't that. But I think maybe some of the message that we can get from this, too, is that we can tend to look at people and say, that's a good opportunity to convert that person. And we may look at somebody else and say, nah, I'm not going to waste my time there and everything. So we can kind of make these judgment calls. What it says here is basically, you know, go after everybody. Get them in here to the feast. You know, everybody is worthy to be here.
And this may be pretty basic, but when he's talking about the lame and the sick or the crippled and bring them in, is he talking about more the dejected Jews, since it's in a town that should have been Jewish? And then when he's talking about the highways and the hedges, I'm so kind of confused about that. Maybe that's more Gentiles, foreigners, if you will, that would be traveling? Or do you think it's even trying to say that it's just go further?
There might be something to that. You know, I think we can oftentimes like overanalyze parables and like apply too much to too many places. I think the general message here is that, you know, the Jews were the optimal audience, like I said. And you know, they didn't all accept it, which you know, I think that's probably understood that they wouldn't. Because I think the Gentiles were in play, even that was the plan the whole time. So I think it just is referring to everybody in all walks of life. Everybody has the opportunity. So this new way that's trying to be relayed as Jesus' ministry happens, and even after Jesus' ministry when the apostles are, is an all-encompassing group of God's people. It's not based on anything. You know, I think, I guess maybe to answer your question more directly, I think probably the application here for like the lame and is probably not as physical as it is spiritual. Is what I kind of have when I read that. That's what I think about. I think about these are people who are spiritually lame. Like there's no chance that this person is ever going to walk. Something like that. There's no chance this person is ever going to be, you know, spiritually able to exist or walk or whatever that might be. But it doesn't matter. Bring them in because they are able to. In this new way, anybody has the opportunity, no matter what they've done, no matter what place they are in life, you have an opportunity to come to this great feast that's being given. Yes, sir.
We have the idea that the closer someone is to whatever we perceive as being the right path, then that would be easier for them. They won't have to change as much stuff in their life, as opposed to somebody who maybe has to blow up everything, their family, their friends, their social habits, all of that has to change. But really, it's those folks who more easily see the need for Jesus when it's presented to them. They're more easily see it, because there is such a huge gap there between what they're doing now and how good things could be if they're on the right path.
If it's totally foreign, then it's like, okay, that is, and you're right. A lot of times it's easier for that person who knows almost nothing or nothing to talk with them and them be receptive to you than it is somebody who's ingrained in whatever it is that they're ingrained in their spiritual life. Yes, sir.
In here too, that he's talking about the invites going out for this dinner. The first people who get called all have an excuse, right? And the next people he calls and he compels to come in. You know, he goes out and he gets the people in the highways and the byways, the lame and the sick, and we can assign whatever we want to that. But it's really interesting. This next section you want to pay attention to is very much focused on commitment. What are you committed to? Well, three people here said they were committed to various things: their land, their tools, their resources, like their oxen, their wife. And there's a time and a place for that commitment where it's all correct. But should there be any commitment greater in our lives than God? And when God raises the flag and says, come to this dinner, you go. If he says, come in here and be baptized for the remission of your sins, because this is how you're going to be saved, there's no other way to do it, you go do that. And I think there's a connection, the thread in here, that's not just this that we've been talking about, but it's also this idea that who needs God? Who recognizes that need and recognizes that it outweighs everything else that could possibly be in our lives? And have we considered that when we make that commitment to him, that it's of that weight, of that gravity, that's just greater than everything else? I think that's a question a lot of the Pharisees completely missed, because their focal point wasn't just the law, it was their traditions and the burdens they bound up on other people that they themselves wouldn't carry. And we can carry that forward to today. When we allow ourselves to bind our opinions and give it the weight of God's word, which it rightly ought not to have.
Yeah, thanks for the segue, because we are going to talk about commitment now in this next section. And so we'll move ahead with that. And so the title in my Bible is Leaving All to Follow Christ. But I think commitment is probably a better kind of like a better mantra to kind of put around this. So commitment to that discipleship that's being talked about here. He says in verse 26, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother and wife and children and brother and sister, yes, in his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And so, again, here we see the relativity comment that's being made, and really the hate is also some of your translations might even say love less. So it's relative to these other things. You know, where does Christ fall in there? Where does God and worship for him fall in there? And in verse 27, I want to look at for just a second. And whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. And so this is the same idea, and some versions might say, take up their cross and follow me. If you look back in Luke 9, in verse 23, he said, then he said to them, this is Luke 9, 23, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and daily, and follow me. And you can look in Mark 8. It's there. There's many places where you see this phrase, take up your cross and follow me. And so my question for you is, what does that mean, take up our cross and follow him? That's like a legit question. Yes.
There's an idea of a burden there, but that wasn't the issue with the cross for people in that day was not because it was heavy and it was hard to carry around. It was the implement of your death. It was the needle, the bullet. That's how you were going to die, and that was what you were carrying with you. And when you carried that, there was only one thing that was going to happen. You were going to die. So nothing else in this world mattered at that point. You were already dead. You're still walking around, but you were dead. And I think that's the idea here, is everything in your life is completely irrelevant except for you following me.
Okay.
Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Back to verse 18, 19, and 20.
Okay.
I mean, they're making excuses and telling them how busy they are. Maybe that's part of that cross. I don't care what you got. Bring that worry with you and come follow me.
Okay. So burden.
So a lot of times we'll hear that, but I do think it's there's sacrifice involved with the cross. That's associated with it. But I think JD's onto something here with this idea that so if we just put ourselves in the first century Rome and take out all the scripture that we know about and everything, and we're just a citizen in Rome, when you see a cross, or when somebody comes up to you and says, okay, get that cross and come on, what's happening? You're gonna die. You're gonna die, just like JD said, because that's an instrument of death. That's the whole point behind it and everything. And so I want you to turn to Romans, the 6th chapter, because I think this probably spells out this radical message that Jesus is trying to relay to them in all these instances where he says, take up your cross and follow me. Where do I want to go? That's John. That's not Romans. It's not going to work. So in Romans 6, beginning in verse 1, what shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Certainly not. How shall we who died to sin live any longer in it? Or do you not know that as many of us as were baptized into Christ were baptized into his death? Therefore we were buried with him through baptism into death. And just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. For if we have been united together in the likeness of his death, certainly we also shall be in the likeness of his resurrection. And now 6 and 7 are really important for what we're talking about right here. Knowing this, that our old man was crucified with him, and that body of sin might be done away with, that we should no longer be slaves to sin, for he who has died has been freed from sin. So I think very literally, not very literally, that's wrong, figuratively, as Christ died, we are to put to death that old man of sin. I think that's what he's calling for here in Luke 14, is not bear the burdens of being a Christian and everything. He's saying, this old man that's sinful, put him to death. Put him to death, and that's the gospel. So what this tells us right here is that every time somebody obeys the gospel, if you look in, it's somewhere here, verse 17, it's talking about that form of doctrine, that pattern of doctrine. And so every time somebody obeys the gospel, they follow that same pattern. With repentance and moving away from those sins, they die with Christ, they're buried with Christ. In baptism, they're raised with Christ as a new person. So I think what he's saying is this is a radical new way of dealing with this stuff. And you have to do that. And Paul even knew that. I want to read two verses real quick in Galatians that Paul mentioned. Galatians 2. Let Galatians 2 and 20, this is Paul, I think, realizing what we're talking about. He says, I've been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. It's very clear, I think, what he's talking about there. Chapter 5 of Galatians, verse 24, it says, and those who are Christ have crucified the flesh with its passion and desire. And so to me, that's a really powerful thing that Jesus is relaying to them here, this idea of taking up your cross and following me. And then we don't have time to go into the rest of this chapter, but he continues to talk about commitment, full commitment to whatever the endeavor is, here specifically talking about service to him. All right, we have people gathering in the back, so we will end with that, and we will pick up next week in Luke 15. We'll talk about the parable of the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son, or the prodigal son, as some people call it. Thank you for your attention and your comments.